Welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, the latest on shares, markets and investments, now available on your Amazon Alexa.
Hello and welcome to the UK Investor Magazine podcast, now also available on the UK Investor Magazine mobile app. For today's podcast, we're going to be discussing in detail UK investment trusts, and to do that, we're kindly joined by Monica Tepez, who is the Investment Companies Research Director at FinCap. Monica, thank you very much for joining the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
So just before we get into the podcast, Monica, congratulations to FinCap, who recently won the UK Investor Magazine Best Small Cap Broker as voted for by our readers. So congratulations on that. But of course, today we're going to be speaking in particular about investment trusts. I mean, just before we do that, Monica, would you be able to give our listeners a brief introduction to yourself and FinCap?
Sure. So FinCap, we are a broker to growth companies. So that would be London listed companies. Within the London Stock Exchange, actually one, I think the largest sector is investment companies, investment trusts, the closed-end funds. They come by different name, but they're all the same. They are funds that are listed on the London Stock Exchange. So there's about probably close to 500 of them now. So I am a research analyst. And our focus is, this bigger sector on the LSE, which is investment companies.
Fantastic. Thank you. So let's get into it now, Monica. I mean, investment trusts, that's your speciality. How, in your view, have they fared over the last 16 months since the beginning of the pandemic?
Yeah. So looking back a bit, the beauty of closed-end funds is that now there's just quite a few of them, as I said, about 500. But they're quite varied. They cover a lot of asset classes. So if you were to look at it overall, you'd be fair to say that they did rather well. And that was in great part helped by quite how diverse they were. So, of course, there have been winners, losers. But nonetheless, I think if you were to have gone out and buy every single fund out there, you would have done pretty well. Which is not surprising, just looking at the state of the markets worldwide, probably the winners have outweighed the losers. And also there's been a lot of support for the losers. So I think there's no surprises there. The big question will be when that support for the sectors that have been badly impacted goes away, is reduced. But in the meantime, there's a lot of money around. So it hasn't been sucked out of the markets. And there have been some asset classes that have done incredibly well. So I think we can go sort of into a bit more detail. I think it's all pretty sort of intuitive, kind of where sort of the winners and losers have been. But overall, and I guess that's the easiest way to know whether a sector is doing well is to look at how much new money is being raised. And there has been a lot of it. So there's a lot of investor interest in the sector.
So, I mean, of course, I mean, the first half of this year has been the best period for IPOs for some years. I mean, is this something that's directly observable in investment trusts? And what do you think is driving the success in raising new money in investment trusts?
Well, it all starts, I guess, with a secondary market, right? So you have funds that are already out there; they are trading. You can go and you buy them, and then the question is that invest when a new fund comes to market, it's like why would you buy this one? If there's other funds around. So if you have funds out there which investors like, but they trade at a premium. So the price that you pay is greater than the value of the underlying assets in those funds. You could say there's more demand than there is supply in the market. So this is when you have a chance, or if a new product comes in, which tells you you can buy this new product and you don't have to pay a premium for it, or it gives you exposure to something different that you already have. Then investors will go for it. And conversely, when it's a difficult time to raise money is when you have a market where a lot of funds are trading on big discounts, because the same questions come in. You know, why would I want to buy a new fund at, say, you know, at par, at the value of the assets, when I could go in the market and buy a sort of a similar or fund for you know, a 20% discount, let's say. So a lot of sectors have been trading really well. They have been on high premiums, which means that that gave the chance for new, let's say, new product, new funds to come to market, where investors feel that they're not overpaying, or, you know, they're buying a fund that is not as expensive as that they would be able to buy in the existing market. And that so IPO, actually, thinking of new money being raised, is dwarfed by the money that has been raised by existing funds, which have post their IPOs, they've done well, the shares have been trading at a premium, and then they have gone out again to raise more money at a discount to the market price, but still a sort of a premium to their net asset value. So there have been, if I'm not mistaken, since March last year, there's probably been nearly 10 billions that has been raised, new money, for existing funds and IPOs, and most of it, probably 80%, has been in funds that have continued to raise money, so rather than IPOs. But yeah, no, so I think that's the clearest sign when you have a market that's doing well, when you have new money sort of coming in, sort of a new shares being issued.
Okay, so I mean, let's just touch on now briefly some of the winners and losers, and then look at the premium and discount. I mean, from what you're seeing, Monica, you know, of course there's been some winners from the pandemic during this period. Of course, healthcare, tech, renewables, losers in the travel sector, anything to do with leisure, hotels. You know, those trusts that are focusing on those sectors, you know, have you seen, you know, those ones with the more favourable sectors, you know, build a significant premium during this period, and those with the ones that haven't done well start to see some form of a discount? And are you starting to see any changes in the premium and discount to some of these winners and losers as we move out of the pandemic?
Yes, definitely. So I think in the, of course, there was the initial shock in March where, you know, a lot of things sort of sold off, including, for example, renewables and probably infrastructure and so on. But that's just a sign of indiscriminate selling. So, and then things recovered quite quickly for, let's call them the winners. And indeed, so the thinking for, you know, renewables, infrastructure, yes. So there's been some significant double-digit premiums there. They have started to come down. So thinking specifically of renewables. So that is a sector that has been incredibly successful over the last, probably coming up to about 10 years now. And so has infrastructure. However, with renewables, I think the headwind, the big headwind that the sector has now is the direction of power prices. Of course, it's the more capacity that you build, if that doesn't if it's not outstripped by supply, you yourself, by providing more capacity, are putting a pressure on prices. And also with all the incentives to for more effective or efficiency when it comes to power, it is undoubted that there is a pressure on power prices. So I think the sector now is at a moment where historically the returns have been great, because there's also have been a lot of yield compression, meaning that the value of the assets that they held, because they have become more and more sought after, have gone up in value. So all those benefit has been had. So investors continue to like the asset class just because historically they had such great returns from it. But I do wonder whether we are reaching now a bit of an inflection point, if you like, where for the last year or so, NAVs have not been going up as strongly, or if some of them have even gone down. And that was because of revised power price expectations. So looking forward, the managers, the expectations are that power prices are not going to be as high as they thought 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago. So that will be interesting to see whether that will be a sector that where there is going to be a shift if this sort of performance starts to come off as power prices are also lower. And also, so that would be sort of on premiums. But by all means, the sector is still trading on premiums, and so is infrastructure. And there's been new money being raised, sort of hundreds of millions. Thinking on the reverse side, so sort of within the losers, yes, there have been sort of the funds that were clearly going to be impacted that have gone to discounts. So if you held leisure property, or even if you think sort of the probably the biggest losers, if you like, or the hardest hits, there are some aviation funds that own aircraft, which has been, you know, grounded for. And so those are not pretty. But of course, the discounts are a function of what you value your assets at. So, and the NAVs do not come out daily, so there is a lag. So whether, you know, as and when these discounts narrow, or these, it's also a function of how much their assets are getting written down. So at the moment, discounts are a, if you like, what investors are saying is that we don't think that the NAV is reflective of the value of the assets. We think it would be lower. But, you know, if the NAVs were to be revised down to a level where you feel like, you know, it can't get worse than this from here, there is outside, then those ratings can change, can improve. You can even find at times where some of these, you can, the prices, these funds could go to trade at a premium. For the same reason, because investors, they might think, you know, the NAVs have the value of the assets has gone up significantly, but the NAVs have not been updated yet. So it's a sort of an anticipation of where NAVs might be. And I guess the other things that can that would influence discounts and premiums is when there is, I guess, whether it would come to a rotation where the winners have run too far. Let's say they're very expensive, and from there the risk is that they are going to derate, and the losers, let's say that they, you know, they hit rock bottom from here, you're entering recovery, and then some money goes from selling what's sort of been has become too expensive, and it moves into assets that have been sold off, but now they're entering a recovery phase. So there are a number of factors that that impact premiums and discounts. It's not just where sort of the value of the assets and whether they have been marked. They are up to date, reflective of the value of the assets, but also of the dynamics in the markets and investors moving money around.
Okay, perfect. So I just want to move on now and look forward now, Monica, to, you know, some emerging sectors. We've obviously touched on there some more traditional sectors within investment trusts that were, of course, impacted heavily by the pandemic. But moving on now and looking forward, we've seen and starting to see a wave of investment trusts coming on, which are focusing on new technologies. You know, in particular, there's been a space investment trust that's just come to market in the last week, and you know there is a focus and probably a demand from investors for those investment trusts that are focusing more on digital sectors. I mean, how are you seeing this play out in markets? Do you feel that there's a very strong demand for investors for these sectors, or is it a case that you think that the issuers are trying to tap in to what they feel will be new technologies going forward, but really we haven't seen investors catch up for it? Or are you seeing, you know, the investor demand really driving the creation of new products?
Well, I think that investors are always sort of what I've noticed over the last 10 years or so in terms of where the demand for funds has been. It has been either in sort of safe income producing assets, This is kind of where you get the kind of infrastructure and renewable sort of low volatility and with a sort of a sustainable income stream, predictable income stream. So at one end. And at the other end, you have the risky stuff, the stuff where it gives you above average, or let's say what the kind of returns that you could get from owning listed equity. So there seems to be kind of and not much in between. So you either investors in the closed-end space have either gone for super safe income or for things that can deliver high growth. Now, where can high growth come from? I think the simplest or the easiest way to do it is sort of to get it from growth markets that are expanding. And thinking of digitalization, that is clearly the big trend, and it's, if nothing else, it has been accelerated dramatically by the last 16 months or so. So it's I guess it's easy for investors to understand why that area has got a lot more room to grow, and why there is, so it's kind of I would say sort of intuitive. And you can see it in your everyday life and how you go about. So from that perspective, I think that it sort of resonates with investors. Space, I have to say, it's not one that I personally sort of would have thought about. But nonetheless, it's clear that it caught investors' interest. So there would be sort of investors want something that's growthy, and they can kind of have a, you know, good feel about why that works. You know, yes, it's a market that will grow dramatically. And tied into that is the fact that everything tech has been doing incredibly well for a long, long time now. So it all, again, it helps when you have a track record, or the history so far has been one of success. So for me, the key question here is, you know, if you were to hit a bad patch, if you were to have a few of these things going badly, you know, probably that would change the dynamic quite a bit. But at the moment, because there have been so many success stories, it's easy for new funds to come and sort of ride on that success, if you like. And tied into this tech is, it's been the theme of private for longer. So the idea that now companies stay private for a lot longer than they did before, and therefore a lot of the growth that they do happens when they're private. And therefore, if you want to get those returns, then you have to go and invest when these companies are private. And there have been funds that have gone there and done that, and they've done it very successfully. And that just, you know, success attracts more more interest. So just the other day, I think one of the funds, they had a holding in Revolut, a fintech company, which, you know, overnight it added, they had made multiples of that investment, and overnight it added 7% to the NAV. So just from one holding to, say, you know, new funding round, we value this holding up. So the returns have been really, really good. Again, for me, the question will be when if the music stops, if these funds do hit a hard patch, or there's going to be run downs in NAV, that will affect investor sentiment. But otherwise, in the meantime, it's quite intuitive that this is a growth area. So I can understand why investors are comfortable investing.
Indeed, certainly an interesting sector to be watching, because as you mentioned there, a lot of the technology companies in the UK are indeed still private. So, you know, if you make comparisons to the United States, for example, in the technology sector there, you know, the products that are available to investors to gain exposure are very different and trade in a different way and have different dynamics underneath them. So that's certainly going to be something, as you said, that's going to be interesting to watch, to see how that develops and whether this momentum is actually able to be sustained within sort of technology and technology investment trusts. But talking about sustaining interest in a particular theme within investment trusts, I want to move on now to ESG, Monica. Now, this is something, if you look last year on a global basis, you know, in 2020, record inflows globally for ESG climate funds, those ones with a strong social impact. But we have seen just recently an apparent flop from Lions Trust and an ESG investment trust unable to raise the 100 million that they set out for. Is this something that you see starting to change in the interest for ESG, or is it just a blip when you're looking at Lions Trust and really we're on a very strong trajectory to the upside in demand for products that are offering a positive impact through the investments that the underlying assets of investment trusts?
Well, I think it's sort of this is a quite a tricky one, because there's no, I guess, exact definition for what, you know, what makes a you know, an ESG investment or a green investment or sustainable, or so even, you know, there's no clear definition to it, or also how you approach it. Sort of, if a company is not run in a sustainable way now, is the way to change the world, if you like, to disinvest, or is it to stick with it and to push for change? Also, if you were to look at certain companies and different agencies which rates how these companies take on sort of measure on different sort of criterias, you will find that with some, the same company could be sort of a very sustainable and green with one, and definitely not with another. So it's not very clear cut to begin with. And pretty much every single fund out there anyway now have an ESG policy. And of course, for me, this is just kind of going mainstream. It's just basic common sense. I'd like to think about it. By all means, there has been a lot of focus on it. I'm just sort of, for me personally, I'm still trying to get my head around sort of what is being measured, what is trying to achieve. I know that all the companies have, you know, policies, but ultimately the question is what does this actually all mean in the real world? So this was kind of just me going on a bit, making the point that me personally, I'm not, you know, I understand what this is trying to achieve ultimately, you know, a more sustainable world, but I'm not quite sure how one, an investor, can look at something or read a policy or kind of get a sense of, you know, yes, this is doing the right thing, or no, it's not doing it. So I'm still working on that. But in terms of you know, investors putting their money where their mouth is, I think probably Lion Trust is not the best example. Maybe there were more specific risks, specific reasons why didn't get away. I think that they had a open-ended product, which was not all that different. So maybe investors said, "Well, I'll happily just buy your other fund." But I think that ultimately investors are primarily driven by returns. So I don't know to what extent they are willing to sacrifice returns for just to get something that is green or sort of tick certain boxes. So looking at the funds that have been successful in this space, you know, renewables funds, the return profile, it's something that I think investors would have liked even if the funds weren't green. The same as there've been some social housing funds. Again, there, I think it's the return that it was attractive, and even if there was no social impact in it. So my feeling at the moment is that to have real demand for a ESG product, the return profile would have to stack up on its own without the benefits that would come from the ESG, if you like. I'm trying to think back. I think there was an attempt by Aberdeen a few years ago to launch an ESG fund, and that failed. And there, I think the returns for me, the reason I think it failed, it was the returns were I think they were targeting something around 6% by investing in illiquid assets, which just is not enough. Even if they were talking about impact and measuring it and so on, I think investors just look at the returns and they ultimately voted with their feet or with their money. So that's my personal opinion is that I'm not saying that there is no demand for something that maybe offers sustainability or is very sustainable investments, but you do give up some of the returns. There will be some demand for it, but I'm not sure that would be sufficient to launch a fund. Investors still want a certain level of returns, and I think the green wrapper, if you want, around it, or a cherry on top, but on itself, I'm not sure that it would succeed.
Indeed, a particularly interesting and complex theme of ESG as it develops. You mentioned some of the key things there, in as far as investors looking at various different products, funds. It seems everything now has some element of ESG. There's problems with measuring. This is a conversation we've had on numerous occasions with different people, and it doesn't seem to be one way of doing things, and people have different views. So I'm sure this is something that is going to develop in the coming years. And again, a very interesting point there on investors, when it boils down to it, are looking for returns, not just looking to have a positive impact or not cause a negative impact with their investment. So it's going to be something that's going to be watched quite keenly, I feel, in the investment trust space as this develops. So Monica, let's just finish off now. We've talked about some fairly broad base and top level themes there, but can we drill down now into what you see, in your opinion, the sort of most exciting sectors are, and really what's caught your interest lately?
Well, I think if you were to kind of go off the beaten track, from the big themes, you have the infrastructure, renewables, the income, the music streaming, and so on. More niche. Actually, probably the first one wouldn't be that niche, but it's a sector that's been around for a long time. So small cap funds, I've been a huge fan of the small cap trusts for forever. I mean, they've been super performers and they haven't disappointed now. And this goes back, I've been around for 15 years or so. And I always could not quite understand why, despite delivering, incredible returns compared to, let's say, all cap funds, they they traded on discounts, PERMA discounts, 10-15% discounts for a decade. And even now, they're on there. But that would be a sector that, for me, it's kind of on all weather. And I know that there's some competition from open-ended funds, and you can't work out perfect statistics to say that you're better off investing in an investment trust. But I would definitely small cap funds. I haven't got to a point where I maybe it's not a sector for all times. But I know a while back I did look if you were to buy equities in the UK over the last 15 years or so, probabilistically, if you were to looking to outperform 1, 3, 5 years, which part of the market you would be best to invest in, whether FTSE 100 or 50 or the 250 or smaller caps. It was the FTSE 250 and the smaller caps that consistent, even over 1 year, but definitely over 3 and 5. At any one point, you would have put money in the market, you would have done better than the FTSE All Share. So, yes, that's one of my favorite sectors, the small cap funds. Now going a bit nichier than that, although small cap is not niche, sorry. Vietnam. So there are three Vietnam funds that invest in Vietnam out there. And Vietnam has have delivered some incredible returns. So that's an area that is not on many people's radar. But Vietnam is sort of a young economy. It's opening up. It's probably where China was, 10 or more years ago. It's in a phase of economics expansion. So it's got all the right fundamentals. You know, the demographics are great. And they've got sort of companies that are delivering. And talking of the world going digital, they're very, very advanced already in that area. So they've delivered some great returns. I think over the last 10 years they've annualized in excess of 10%, probably 15% per annum. So that would be an area that I think has got great fundamentals. And probably last one, if I was to go like a really, really niche now, uranium. So thinking of climate change and so on, and I know there's a lot of renewables going around, but one source of clean energy is uranium. And there is one fund called Geiger Counter, which invests in small cap uranium miners. So the uranium price is still very low compared to its peak. But this is, and it has been moving up over the last year or two. So for example, the fund, I think over 1 year has doubled in value, but there's still a lot to go. So if you were to look for areas where you could have sort of super growth, the share price going up multiple times, I think that's an interesting one. But again, it's very niche-y, but I just thought it would maybe put sort of in perspective the big trends versus what happens in sort of smaller niche markets.
Yes, thank you. I mean, some of those sectors, particularly Vietnam, is one that regular listeners to the podcast will be aware of. We've had Craig Martin from Vietnam Holding on the podcast a number of times, and there is actually a video of their latest investment presentation on the UK Investor Magazine website in the video section there. So do check that out. That's a particularly interesting fund. And of course, their uranium, as you said, is very niche, but potentially very exciting. Just to finish off, I just had one more final question, Monica. I mean, how have you seen, just going back to the small cap funds, mm-hmm. how have you seen the premium discount behave through the pandemic for small cap funds?
Yeah, so definitely they in the initial stages they sold off massively, as you'd expect. I mean, there's a lot of these small businesses, not all of them would be new technology digital, right? So a lot of them, but now they've come back, and I think at the moment, looking at the discounts, they've been narrower than they have been, historically, looking back, 10, 15 years. The performance has been great. Some of them have even, Throckmorton Trust, I think they've been issuing new shares, which again, if you go back the last 15 years, it's been pretty much unheard of to have these funds trading at a premium, never mind to issue shares. I'm pleased to see that. I have wondered for many years whether they will ever get to trade at premiums, but no, still they are sort of in single digit discounts, most of them. But by historic standards, they are narrower than usual, and they did narrow out quite badly in the 16 months ago. But they have recovered since, and I guess that's sort of probably similar to the most of the equity markets.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So that was Monica Tepes, who is the Investment Companies Research Director at FinCap. Monica, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. So also, just as a note, in the podcast notes, you're going to be able to find a link through to some relevant stories on the UK Investor Magazine, to some of the themes that we have touched on today in the podcast. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed listening to the UK Investor Magazine podcast. Please do share the podcast, and we really value any reviews and comments you leave us in your chosen podcast player. The views presented by the hosts and guests of the UK Investor Magazine podcast are in no way investment advice, and please remember, all investment involves risk.